Today, the long haul, the DFA Daily for the 10th of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Before I start, first a quick thanks to those who subscribe via my YouTube channel. We just crossed 38,000 and I'm so grateful for your interest and support. We'll continue to bring you the latest unvarnished news and a range of views and opinions to bring some of our most sacred cows into the spotlight. I may not agree with all my guests, but that's not the point. Presenting a range of views and differing perspectives is. And to illustrate that, I'm trying an experiment on Tuesday the 12th of May at 8 p.m. Sydney, where I'm running a live Q&A session on Bitcoin's halving, which of course is due very soon now, as well as a broader discussion on crypto. And I'll be joined live by Alex Saunders from Nuggets News. Alex and I collaborate on a monthly economic and finance update. The latest just came out. And so he's going to return the favour. And I'll see if I can run a live stream to YouTube and a Zoom session at the same time. And now turning to the latest data, our Household Financial Confidence Index improved a little in April, up from 73.2 in March to 75.8 in April. That said, it's still well below the 100, which is a neutral setting, meaning that households are extremely cautious about their finances. Across our wealth segments, those free affluent households recovered the most, mainly thanks to a recovery in stock markets over the past month. Those renting are benefiting from falling rents, although many have income shocks to deal with, while those with a mortgage showed little evidence of a recovery in confidence, thanks to rising debt concerns. Across the age bands, those aged 50 to 60 showed the strongest bounce, while those aged 23 to 30 reported a further fall, not least because younger households tend to be more exposed to zero-hour contracts and part-time employment, not supported by JobKeeper. The recovery in confidence was evident across all the states, with New South Wales and Victoria on average more positive, relatively speaking, than South Australia and Western Australia. And across our property segmentation, owner-occupied households improved, as did those not holding property, but property investors fell again, thanks to less support from banks in terms of mortgage repayment holidays and falling rents and occupancy. Around 8% of property investors are seriously looking to sell their property if they can. The true state of play is best shown when we look at the moving parts of the index. 67% of households now feel less secure regarding their job prospects than a year ago, and that's a rise of 28% from last month. There was a 14% rise in those feeling less comfortable with their savings to 56% of households, and there was a clear intent to try and save more in the months ahead, given current uncertain economic times. 65% of households are less comfortable with their ability to service debt, a rise of more than 20% of households, and this despite falling interest rates and bank support schemes. Around $160 billion worth of loans have received some leniency from the banks, but that is a small share of the $1.7 trillion mortgage sector and the $280 billion SME sector. Income pressures are mounting, with 14% saying their incomes had fallen to 66% of households, while under 1% saw any rise in income, including some who will benefit from higher incomes under JobKeeper than they would normally receive. Costs of living continue to drive higher, despite the fall in oil prices, with many households incurring greater costs because they're spending more time at home. And 94% said their costs were higher than a year ago. And finally, household net worth was lower for 65% of households, reflecting stock market and property price adjustments and rising debt levels. And there was a drop of 11% in households claiming net worth had risen over the past year to 18% of households. So we think the longer term impacts on households are yet to be fully understood. Certainly, our data suggests households will be cautious as income pressures, cost of living and rising debts bite. If home prices slide further as we expect they will, then household net worth will put a further brake on the wealth effect and will also adversely impact many households. And all of this doesn't suggest a V-shaped recovery to me. Now, the Foreign Investment Review Board released their figures for 2018-19. This includes all types of foreign investment, including real estate. This was the report which triggered calls from the property sector to open up the market to Chinese buyers again this week. The report is tricky in that while it gives glimpses of various cuts on the data, some critical ones like residential investment by foreign country are omitted. I think this is deliberate. The underlying data is just not available to the public. The value of proposed investment applications increased by $67.9 billion to $231 billion, with the number of transactions valued at $2 billion or greater increasing from 2 in 2017-18 to 23 during this reporting period. Business investment is at its highest level since 2015 and 16, and this year it increased by over $65 billion to $216.2 billion. While the number of proposed transactions approved dropped by approximately 2,500 as a result of a fall in the number of residential real estate applications, the value of proposed investments in this sector actually increased by just $2 billion to $14.8 billion. In 2018-19, as in 2017-18, the United States was the largest source country of proposed investment applications by value. Canada was the next largest source, followed by Singapore, Japan, and then China. The reduction in proposed investment applications by value from China reflects an ongoing downward trend in the value of Chinese investment from its peak in 2015-16. And this can be attributed to a range of factors such as China's internal domestic policy settings, including increased scrutiny of outbound investment and stricter capital controls. The fall in Chinese investment reflects a broader trend, which has seen a decline in outward bound global Chinese investment since 2016. The FIRB said that in 2018-19, a total of 7,513 residential real estate applications were approved for proposed investments worth $14.8 billion. This is a 2,523 decline in the number of approvals from 2017-18 and continues a trend seen since 2015-16. Despite this, 2018-19 saw an increase in the value of proposed investment by residential real estate by $2.3 billion, representing an 18% increase on the previous year. This increase can be attributed almost solely to the approval for development residential real estate exemption certificates. An analysis of residential real estate data since 2015-16 indicates a dampening of foreign demand for residential real estate. Many factors may explain the fall in the number of residential real estate approvals. These include foreign investment application fees, a tightening of domestic credit, and increased restrictions on capital transfers in home countries, state taxes, and foreign residential stamp duty increases, and the introduction of an exemption certificate so that only one approval is required for individuals considering a number of residential properties with the intention to purchase just one property. And in 2018-19, the number of residential real estate approvals for proposed purchases in New South Wales and Victoria fell to 60% of all approvals given to single states and territories, and the value of residential real estate approvals in these two states together fell by roughly 25% compared to the previous financial year. Given the lag between new approvals and construction starts, the forward view of likely construction sector jobs looks pretty weak. And this mirrors recent weaker building development approvals, which we discussed the other day. And it's also worth highlighting that it appears to me that there was a significant fall in the number of larger construction projects, in other words, high-rise projects, compared with a few years ago. And that, I think, is a very significant development too. Now over to the US, because total non-farm payroll employment fell by 20.5 million in April, and the unemployment rate rose to 14.7%, according to the US Bureau of Labor Statistics. The changes in these measures reflect the effects of the virus and efforts to contain it. Employment fell sharply in all major industry sectors, with particularly heavy job losses in leisure and hospitality. Now, this information comes from statistics drawn from two surveys. The Household Survey measures labour force status, including unemployment, by demographic characteristics, and the Establishment Survey measures non-farm employment hours and earnings by industry. In April, the unemployment rate increased by 10.3 percentage points to 14.7%. This is the highest rate and the largest over-the-month increase in the history of the series, which, season-adjusted, goes right back to January 1948. The number of unemployed persons rose by 15.9 million to 23.1 million in April. And the sharp increase in these measures reflects the effects of the coronavirus pandemic and efforts to contain it. In April, unemployment rates rose sharply among all major worker groups. The rate was 13% for adult men, 15.5% for adult women, 31.9% for teenagers, which is a disastrous number, 14.2% for whites, 16.7% for blacks, 14.5% for Asians, and 18.9% for Hispanics. The rate for all of these groups, with the exception of blacks, represented record highs for their respective series in April. The number of unemployed persons who were jobless less than 5 weeks increased by 10.7 million to 14.3 million, accounting for almost two-thirds of the unemployed. And the number of unemployed persons who were jobless 5 to 14 weeks rose by 5.2 million to 7 million. And the number of long-term unemployed, those jobless for 27 weeks or more, at 939,000 declined by 225,000 over the month, and represented 4.1% of the unemployed. The labour force participation rate decreased by 2.5 percentage points over the month to 60.2%, the lowest rate since January 1973, when it was 60%. And total employment, as measured by the Household Survey, fell by 22.4 million to 133.4 million. The employment population ratio at 51.3% dropped by 8.7 percentage points over the month, and this is the lowest rate and the largest over-the-month decline in the history of the series. The number of persons who usually work full-time declined by 15 million over the month, and the number who usually work part-time declined by 7.4 million, and part-time workers accounted for one-third of the over-month employment decline. The number of persons at work part-time for economic reasons nearly doubled over the month to 10.9 million. These individuals, who would have preferred full-time employment, were working part-time because their hours had been reduced or they were unable to find full-time jobs. This group includes persons who usually work full-time and persons who usually work part-time. The number of persons not in the labour force who currently want a job at 9.9 million, nearly doubled in April. These individuals were not counted as unemployed because they were not actively looking for work during the last 4 weeks or were unavailable to take a job. Persons marginally attached to the labour force, which is a subset of persons not in the labour force who currently want a job, numbered 2.3 million in April, up by 855,000 over the month. And these individuals were not in the labour force, wanted and were available for work, and had looked for a job sometime prior to 12 months, but had not looked for work in the 4 weeks preceding the survey. Discouraged workers, a subset of the marginally attached, who believed that no jobs were available for them, numbered 574,000 in April, which is actually a little change from the previous month. And finally, non-farm payroll employment fell by 20.5 million in April, after declining by 870,000 in March. The April over-the-month decline is the largest in the history of the series and brought employment to its lowest level since February 2011. And by the way, that series dates back to 1939. Job losses in April were widespread, with the largest employment decline occurring in leisure and hospitality, which plummeted by 7.7 million or 47%. Almost three-quarters of the decrease occurred in food services and drinking places, down 5.5 million. Employment also fell in the arts, entertainment and recreation industry, down 1.3 million, and in the accommodation industry, down 839,000. Employment declined by 2.5 million in education and healthcare services in April, and in healthcare, employment declined by 1.4 million, led by losses in offices of dentists, down 503,000, offices of physicians down 243,000, and offices of other healthcare practitioners down 205,000. Unemployment also declined in social assistance, down 651,000, reflecting job losses in child daycare services, down 336,000, and individual and family services, down 241,000. And employment in private education declined by 457,000. In April, average hourly earnings for all employees on private non-farm payrolls increased by $1.34 to $30.01. The increases in average hourly earnings largely reflect the substantial job losses among lower paid workers. And this change, along with earnings increases, puts upward pressure on the average hourly earnings estimates. And the reason I've gone through this in somewhat painful detail is that this, I think, gives us a much better glimpse of what is really happening in the employment sector. And I think you can read that across to Australia. So I expect to see a proliferation of unemployment rising amongst lower paid, amongst those in part-time roles. And as a result, the average take-home earnings could actually go up, despite the fact that the unemployment rate will be rising. So we'll keep an eye on that in the weeks ahead. And finally, the Fed reported their latest weekly balance sheet, and it was up again. But they are flattening their curve, it seems. Total assets on the Fed's balance sheet rose by just $65 billion during the week ended May the 6th. That's the smallest weekly increase since the week of February the 26th, when assets fell by just $13 billion. And it was down 89% from the peak bailout number in the week ended March the 25th. But that said, total assets now stands at $6.72 trillion. And just to put that in context, if the Fed had spread the increase of $2.34 trillion equally over the 130 million households in the US, each household would have been able to receive $18,535. And for many households, that would have been welcome help to get through the crisis. But no, of course, this is all about helicopter money for Wall Street. Looking at the main components, the Fed slashed its purchase of Treasury securities. Mortgage-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities, after falling last week, remained flat. And repurchase agreements were also flat. Lending to special purpose vehicles, through which the Fed earlier on said it would buy bonds, junk bonds, bond EFTs and other things too, actually fell, and the Fed still has not bought any junk bonds, or fallen angel junk bonds, or bond EFTs, or junk bond EFTs, but the announcement that they made in March that it might buy them was re-announced last Monday, and they're now saying they might start buying by early May, and that caused a huge rally in those particular asset classes. So the Fed is still prepared to buy anything that moves, really. Their Paycheck Protection Program liquidity facility rose to $25 billion, up $8 billion from 2 weeks ago. And the Fed's dollar liquidity swap lines with other central banks ticked up by $6 billion to $445 billion. All of that increase was with the Bank of Japan, which now accounts for $220 billion of the swaps, or nearly 50% of the total. Swaps with the ECB, the second largest user, was flat at $143 billion, which is 32% of the total, and swaps with the Bank of England also remained flat at $28 billion, or 6% of the total. The Fed's swaps with the central banks of Australia, Denmark, Norway, Switzerland, Singapore, South Korea, and Mexico remained at the same relatively small level, and the largest counterparty in that group was actually the Bank of Korea, with $17 billion in swaps. And the Fed's swap lines with the central banks of Canada, Brazil, New Zealand and Sweden remain unused. It's worth remembering that these swaps mature in either 7 days or 84 days, and the Fed lends newly created dollars to other central banks and takes domestic currency as collateral at the market exchange rate. When the swap matures, the Fed gets its dollars back and the other central bank gets its own currency back, and the balances by country are reported by the New York Fed. And just remember that the Fed has injected $2.41 trillion since the 11th of March with the aim of protecting the financial system and its investors. This actually has very little to do with the real economy, And the Fed also wants to restart the chase for yields as investors up their risk appetite, knowing that the good old Fed will always bail them out. And the bigger your holdings, the greater the Fed bailout is. And this is one more reason why I think the global economy will be in struggle street for some time, despite all the talk of a bounce back. Unemployment will be higher, wages growth will be lower, debt will be bigger, and mortgage and other loan defaults will be higher. This appears to me to be a roadmap for a long, slow road. And as I discussed on Friday, even the RBA is talking about higher unemployment for some long time ahead, while inflation will stay well below their target rates. So we had better prepare for the long haul. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.